Thank you, and it's good to be with you again today. I was saying to James that I was asked to take part in a summer series at our own church. The series was entitled Oddballs of the Old Testament. And I was given the task of preaching on Rehoboam, and when I came to look at those passages, I realized I'd never preached on that before, it was quite a task. But having gone through that task and thinking about today, I thought I would share something of that again with you today. But I have actually retitled the sermon, Illusion or Reality? Illusion or Reality? And it really is a bit of a family saga. If I can get this thing to work. Rehoboam, son of Solomon, grandson of David. That's the context in which we're thinking today. David, the great king of Israel, had won peace with an aggressive military campaign, and Israel was united against any threats that came against it. The kingdom grew, not only in territory, but also increased in wealth. David built himself a grand palace, and the people were building their homes after 40 years wandering in a wilderness and living in tents. They started to build brick houses, or, well, stone, whatever they built with, but they were permanent houses. And David, as I say, had built or was building this grand palace for himself. But here was the tabernacle, still. The tabernacle that had traveled with them. The place where God lived. He was still in his tent. And David thought, we ought to build him a house. But, as we know, God said to David, that wasn't to be his task. But that was to fall to Solomon, his son. Now Solomon was renowned for his wisdom, and that was a choice that he had made right at the beginning of his reign when asked what he wanted by God. He wanted wisdom to lead this great people. And the kingdom continued to grow in territory and wealth. And I'm going to be primarily in Chronicles. I said that I would bring the reading myself today, so because I really want to jump around a bit. And if you turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 9, first of all, 2 Chronicles chapter 9 and verses 22 and well, beginning at 22, 23, and then I'm going to jump to 27. This is what it says of King Solomon. He was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. All the kings of the earth sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. And then verse 27 of 2 Chronicles 9, the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Just a flavor of what was happening from those verses. Indeed, I confess, or I acknowledge, rather, that I've got a great deal from Charles Swindoll's writings on Rehoboam. And he says this: the surrounding kingdoms held Israel in high regard because of David's military might and Solomon's wise diplomacy and the power of the Hebrews' God. David, Solomon, and then came Rehoboam. And it's Rehoboam that I really want to look at this morning. Charles Swindoll calls him a phony.
I should have been right. Okay, there we are. He's the master of illusion.
Indeed, Swindoll says of Rehoboam, hypocrisy defines his life. What a sad thing to have said of you. Hypocrisy defines his life. And therefore, I want to look through just one or two of the illusions that he tried to paint. First of all, the illusion of taking advice. And if you turn on, or just go on to 2 Chronicles 10, and I want to read the first 17 verses there. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone there to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and all Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." Rehoboam answered, "Come back to me in 3 days." So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. They replied, "If you will be kind to these people and please them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants." But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father put on me?'" Or put on us, sorry. The young men who had grown up with him replied, "The people have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us.' But make make our yoke lighter. Now tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.'" So 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, "Come back to me in 3 days." The king answered them harshly, rejecting the advice of the elders. He followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from God, to fulfill the word that the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah, the Shilonite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, Israel, look after your own house, David." So all the Israelites went home. That sets the scene of the beginning of Rehoboam's reign. He went to the elders
to ask their advice. However, they would probably be considered the old guard. And Jeroboam, the guy that had fled to Egypt, he was Solomon's old adversary. So Rehoboam was a bit wary of him, no doubt. Anyway, when he went to the elders, he didn't get the answer he wanted. However, he wanted to be seen to be doing the right thing, which I think is why he first went to the elders. He knew very well that he was going to turn to those that were closest to him. He turned to his boyhood friends. That phrase there in the Bible of the young friends literally would be translated the lads. He turned to the lads that had grown up with him. And they naturally agreed with him. Because? Well, the message puts it this way. They were those who were now currying his favor. They were currying his favor, and they would agree with him, wouldn't they? Just as we look at this part of Rehoboam's life and the wording that is used, just a quick note here about verses 11 and 14 where it mentions scorpions. Probably not referring to literal scorpions, but a scorpion was likely to be the lash that had a single handle with up to 12 leather straps, each embedded with pieces of bone or metal. Whereas the whip, which is also mentioned there, comprised of a handle with one leather strap. So you see what he's comparing. Not just a whip with one strap, but I'm going to whip you with that which has 12 straps and embedded with bone or metal. The result of all this, well, Charles Swindle puts it in this way, thanks to the arrogance and the foolishness of the reckless phony, the promised land became a divided kingdom for the first time. And the reason I emphasize the growth of the kingdom under David and Solomon, it was growing in size, it was growing in wealth, but suddenly now that kingdom is divided. So that was the first illusion of taking advice. But there was another illusion, the illusion of obedience. If you go to chapter 10 and verse 18, King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, but the Israelites stoned him to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. That's emphasizing the division that came. Excuse me a moment. Chapter 11, verse 1. When Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the house of Judah and Benjamin, 180,000 able young men. Oh, turn two pages. To make war against Israel and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam. But this word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, the man of God. Say to Rehoboam and the son of Solomon, king of Judah, and to all Israel in Judah and Benjamin, this is what the Lord says. Do not go up to fight against your fellow Israelites. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. So they obeyed the words of the Lord and turned back from marching against Jerusalem. Against Jeroboam. Rehoboam lived in Jerusalem and built up towns for defense in Judah: Bethlehem, Etam, Tekoa, Bethzur, Soko, Adullam, Gath, Marishah, Ziph, Adoniram, Lachish, Azekah, Zora, Ajalon, and Hebron. These were fortified cities in Judah and Benjamin. He strengthened their defenses and put commanders in them with supplies of food, olive oil, and wine. He put shields and spears in all the cities and made them very strong. So Judah and Benjamin were his. Verse 4, having been told not to fight, he goes home. Verse 5, turns his hand to fortifying the cities, the towns that he holds. And he spent years preparing his cities for war. Yes, he was fearful of Jeroboam and Israel, but probably also fearful of Egypt, and those towns were in that sort of direction, because Egypt had been the ally of Jeroboam. That's where he'd gone to flee to when he fled from Solomon. And near the end of both accounts of his life, in both Chronicles and Kings, the historians add the note: there was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. That's in 2 Chronicles 12:15. Continual war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So as there was this illusion of peace. He didn't immediately go to fight, but he prepared for war. And so that's the second illusion. The third illusion was an illusion of well-being and devotion. If we go on to chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 1. After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all Israel with him abandoned the law of the Lord because they had been unfaithful to the Lord. Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen and the innumerable troops of Libyans, Sukkites, and Cushites that came with him from Egypt. He captured the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. And then if you just drop down further to verse 9. When Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem, he carried off the treasuries of the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including the gold shields that Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made bronze shields and to replace them and assigned these to the commanders of the guard on duty at the entrance to the royal palace. Whenever the king went to the Lord's temple, the guards went with him bearing the shields, and afterwards they returned them to the guardroom. An act going on here. the golden symbol of the kingdom's wealth and might. Because Rehoboam had turned away from God, God allowed Shishak, the king of Egypt, to come and attack. And it was pilfered. The wealth was pilfered by the Egyptians. But to keep up the illusion for the people around, whereas Egypt, Shishak took all the gold from the temple, Rehoboam replaced it with bronze imitation. Such hypocrisy. Bronze shields polished to shine like gold, but worthless by comparison. Here again we see the master of illusion. But in all of this, as I've thought about Rehoboam, I think, you know, going back to this whole issue of the family that he came from, there was a deeper fundamental issue. There was the family. Listen to, if you go back into 2 Chronicles 11, 11:21b, in all he had 18 wives and 60 concubines, 28 sons and 60 daughters. Rehoboam appointed Abijah, son of Machir, as crown prince among his brothers in order to make him king. He acted wisely, dispersing some of his sons throughout the districts of Judah and Benjamin and to all the fortified cities. He gave them abundant provisions and took many wives for them. But just before we say too much about Rehoboam, Rehoboam was a chip off the old block. His father had had a few wives, not quite as many as that, I don't think. His grandfather had a few wives, but not as many as that. His father, though, had far more than we read there. And in a moment, I'll give you some figures on that. But here we see Rehoboam not only satisfied building his own harem, but he was also getting wives for his sons and building up the harem for them. And the word that is rendered wisely in verse 23, he acted wisely, dispersing his sons, etc., etc., gives the impression of approval, that it was a thing that was good and honorable. However, the word is usually translated skillfully, or maybe even shrewdly. And to his own ends. Yet another illusion that he wanted to build up. Maybe a saying apt for this particular instance is one that I have been heard to use on a number of occasions in various contexts. I blame the parents. I blame the parents. Sadly, in the end, if we we're still on the family. I haven't got a note here when to turn it on, so apologies for that. So that was Rehoboam. Now Solomon. Okay, 1 Kings 11. Let me take you back to 1 Kings 11. Just a few verses there, 1 to 4. But this will give you something of the flavor. 1 Kings 11. Sorry, that's 2 Kings. No wonder it doesn't look right. First Kings 11:1. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. See what I mean? And his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. And that's the key thing in all of this. Sadly for Solomon, in the end, his wives turned his heart. I should have held my finger in 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, back to chapter 12. I hope you've held it. 2 Chronicles, chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. King Rehoboam established himself firmly in Jerusalem and continued as king. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned for 17 years in Jerusalem, the city of the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. He did evil because he had not set his heart on seeking the Lord. Now, that's an interesting juxtaposition of thoughts there in that phrase. Charles Swindoll puts it this way: Rehoboam lived in a city called Jerusalem, city of peace. This was the city where God wanted his name to be prominent. But the writer of Chronicles suddenly puts in, the writer interjects into that verse, Rehoboam's mother's name, Naamah, the woman from Ammon. Rehoboam wanted his capital to look like the city of the Lord, but underneath it was, in fact, quite the opposite. It was the city of Naamah, the Ammonitess, and her idols, Molech and Milcom. And one archaeologist writes, Molech was a detestable Semitic deity honored by the sacrifice of children. Palestinian excavations have uncovered evidences of infant skeletons in burial places around heathen shrines. No form of ancient Semitic idolatry was more abhorrent than Molech worship. And you'll notice there, the fact, or let me say this, we could go to the verses. It talks about Rehoboam being 41 years old when he became king. Solomon had reigned in Jerusalem as king for 40 years. Okay? Solomon reigned for 40 years. Rehoboam was 41 when he became king. So while Dad was busy ruling over Israel, and the kingdom was expanding, and the wealth was growing, people were coming to hear his wisdom. While Dad was busy, Rehoboam was being nurtured by Mum, the worshipper of Molech. But Solomon consented to all of that. Charles Swindoll, again, he says this, "The sin that Mum loved and Dad permitted ensnared the son." And of course, then there was David that came before. And we know some of his problems as far as wives were concerned. Let me just say this. Sorry. A wife is not a bad thing, okay? Mine's not here, so I can say what I like in a sense, although Karen knows my wife, so messages might get back. But a wife is not a bad thing. But for me, one is ample. Lovely as she is, one is ample. So let me, I don't know what sort of picture I've painted. It's a difficult puzzle to sort of put together here. But I want just now to try and draw things together, because I think out of all of this come two fundamental lessons. And I've always already hinted at them really, but the two fundamental lessons. And one is our heart relationship and devotion towards God. I've mentioned David and Solomon and Rehoboam in all of this. Listen to what the Acts of the Apostles in Acts 13 verse 22, the writer there says this, "God testified concerning David, I have found David, son of Jesse, a man after my own heart. For all that David went through, for all the problems that he had, for the times that he failed, God says of him, he was a man after my own heart." David ignored God's restrictions against Hebrew men marrying pagan women, who might lead them into idolatry, and kings taking multiple wives. He compromised in that one area, but his heart never turned to idols. His sensuality led him to commit adultery and murder, but he never tolerated a rival religion. And of course, when challenged by the prophet, he acknowledged his sin. He repented of his sin. And you can see something of that in Psalm 51, and I haven't time to take you to Psalm 51. But that is David's heartfelt plea and prayer to God when the prophet Nathan had challenged him. And of course, the key thing in all of that was God forgave him. But then there was Solomon. Solomon took after his father, perhaps thinking that since David's devotion survived the potential hazard, his would as well. However, his wives led him to build places of worship to false gods and enticed him to participate with them. And then there was Rehoboam. Behind the scenes, he did as his father and grandfather did, but in all of it was maintaining a public perception that he held a steadfast devotion towards God, but He didn't.
And the key thing is that heart relationship. But I suppose fundamental to that is the Father heart of God. I don't know about you, but as I've gone over a period of time reading here, there, and everywhere, there's one guy that keeps popping up with all sorts of quotes from in different sort of contexts, it seems to me. But they always seem to be to the point. And that's a guy called Mark Twain. Mark Twain says this: "Everyone is a moon and has a dark side, which they never show to anybody." Think about it. I guess as I look around this room, I know it for myself. There are things about me that I wouldn't particularly want you to know. And I guess all of us have that side to us. Things we're not particularly proud of. Things we keep to ourselves. Everyone is a moon and has a dark side, which they never show to anybody. We may try to hide the dark side of our moon from others. But we cannot hide them or hide it, hide anything from God. We sang about that earlier. We are totally open to Him. And I'd like to take you, but time fails it. I would encourage you to go again to Psalm 139, that lovely Psalm of David, when he talks about trying to go wherever to get away from God, but he acknowledges that he can. A lovely, lovely psalm of the heart of God. But I would just ask you this. The fact that God knows so much about you, things that you might want to hide from others, is that a frightening thought? Or comforting? A comforting reality. God is constantly looking to forgive. That's the heart of God. It was true of David. When God sent the prophet to him, David responded. It was true too for Solomon, although sadly, in the end, he seemed to allow other things to draw him away from that true devotion to God. It was even true for Rehoboam. And if you go into that passage a little further, you'll find that he was challenged. And we read that he repented, but then carried on. So God was even trying to forgive him. But I suppose our question today is, where do we stand in all of that? What about me? What about you?
we all stand where Mark Twain puts us in that sense. But are we going to be like Rehoboam, masters of illusion, putting on a front and it's all unreal? It's phony. Or are we going to be like David, the one who God was able to say, he's a man after my own heart? That's the challenge. But that's the grace of God too, that he's constantly seeking us and wanting us to be those people that have that true heart relationship with him.